Mary chipped her front tooth in the monkey bars acting like an idiot.
She made a big scene and had to go get her tooth capped. It looks normal, I guess.
Here, give me that.
Told you she had a capped tooth.
Elm trees. How many pages can you write about dying trees? Here, something about Dominic. Palazzolo jumped off the roof today over that rich bitch Porter. How stupid can you be? Today we went out on the boat. It was pretty cold. We saw a couple of whales. Lux leaned over and stroked the whale. I didn't think they would stink so much. It's the kelp in their baleens rotting. I hope we can go again sometime. Finland history's history that. Lux lost it over Kevin Hines.
The garbage man.
The garbage man.
Lux lost it over Kevin Haynes, the garbage man. She'd wake up at 5 in the morning and hang out casually on the front steps, like it wasn't completely obvious. She wrote his name and marker on all her bras and underwear, and Mom found them and bleached out all the Kevins. Lux was crying on her bed all day. The trees like lungs filling with air. My sister, the mean one, pulling my hair.
And so we started to learn about their lives. Coming to hold collective memories of times we hadn't experienced, we felt the imprisonment of being a girl. The way it made your mind active and dreamy and how you ended up knowing what colors went together. We knew that the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. We knew that they knew everything about us, and that we couldn't fathom them at all.
Welcome to I Know Movies and You Don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Broad. If you're joining us this season, we've been talking about the idea of coming of age and whether that is the transitions within our lives, whether it's adolescence to adulthood, whether it is midlife crises, all of these ideas of going beyond the veil, extending beyond, having an awakening. And once you've gone to a different point of life, you cannot necessarily go back to that state of innocence that you had. And so coming of age is about shedding about that innocence, looking upon things in a different light. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, as we weave it, ebb and out of the flow of perspectives, the perspectives that we have, the perspective that drives it, whether it's gender, whether it is place, whether it is culture. Today, we're going to be coming back to an idea as we ebb and flow through these various perspectives, coming back, revisiting, and returning to that of the feminine perspective, and what it has to say about the state of womanhood, the state of the feminine experience as it relates to the adolescent, the emergence of adolescence, the expectations that women have, particularly from shedding adolescence to adulthood, and what that takes on in the form of society, you know, parentally, culturally, all of the like. And so it's a very specific form. And so I think it makes sense to talk about it and frame it in the way that the movie frame that we're talking about frames it today, in a sense of barriers, in a sense of that we don't necessarily understand what we're looking at. We don't necessarily understand based off of the limitations that we have, the limitations of those experiences, and not necessarily being able to sit and understand what is going on mentally, what is going on experientially, what is going on imaginatively in people. And that sense of barriers, I think, makes sense in orchestrating it around the idea of the suburban monoculture that is oppressive in America. And whether or not you've all, I'm sure, experienced the idea of suburbia, the idea of inclusion, the idea of separation in the form of communities made at the escape of most societies, most urban centers. You have at it, whether the experience is outside of Atlanta, whether it's outside of Michigan, whether it's in, you know, lowly Burbank, California, where I grew up, suburbia, you know, persists across America. And it reminds us of our desire to conform with those around us, reminding us, you know, to water our lawns, to cut our grass, despite the fact that it could be wasteful in the summer. It is about maintaining the sense of uniformity, conformity that suburban spaces offer. And it's these spaces that form a community founded on a desire of sameness, a shared sense of appearances, place bearing on a kind of social standing rather than it is about its experience of individuality. You know, when a neighbor's lawn is unkempt, someone calls the HOA and brings down the full force of that conformity upon them. But this all is an illusion. It's a facade, and it's always been so. We've seen this in filmmakers, you know, stretch upon their entire careers, whether it is in the subversive cinema of John Waters, you know, lamenting his own upbringing into the religious suburban uniformity around him, whether it is, you know, David Lynch and breaking down suburbia and the darkness underneath in Blue Velvet, whether it's Tim Burton and his exposure of his own lamenting of Burbank itself with, you know, the ideas of suburbia in Edward Scissorhands or Beetlejuice or otherwise. You know, this illusion has been known and it has been used to, you know, decipher an idea of American separation, American isolation in this sense of communities, because these communities do not, they basically have within it social disruptors, seedy lies that ready to tear the fabric of these communities as based off of the faulty foundation. These neighbors aren't very neighborly at all. And while planned for people to live near one another, suburban communities do not foster community. They foster barriers. They foster separation. The guiding force of suburbia asks for the threads to unravel the first sign of social mishap based off of this faulty notion. And it's this idea of barriers erected and this idea of perspectives lauded in isolation that drives the center universe created by Sofia Coppola in a haunting pastel-infested version of the 1970s suburb in The Virgin Suicides. Certain doom is always just around the corner within this universe. We see it in the dying trees scattered through the neighborhood lawns and in the chemical stench that infests the city in the final scenes of the movie caused by a spill at a nearby industrial plant. You know, this is a rich, isolated neighborhood, but the film's background cannot escape the kind of existential, ecological, and perverse cultural catastrophe that is just on, you can say it's on the outside, but you could also say that it's a toxicity that's festering within the community itself. You cannot necessarily hide from the disease, and in essentially so doing, you know, the idea that these barriers, these walls keep it from spreading, that is just a fanciful notion that cannot be tested against the reality. It will spread. It will find itself and ignite. And the Virgin Suicides is reflecting on this quiet descent into a hell of these five girls who have the toxicity perhaps within them. Perhaps it's because of their isolated senses, because of their situations. We have Cecilia, we have Lux, we have Bonnie, we have Mary, we have Therese. And we see them through the loving gaze of young boys from the neighborhood and told by them 25 years later as grown-ups. These golden-haired, light-dressed, adolescent, fantastical entities are seen only through the lens of distance and perspective. And it's thoroughly, you know, a thorough and accurate adaptation from Jeffrey Eugenides' 1993 novel, as he utilizes a unique pastel melancholia to reflect on these elusive ideas, the elusive idea of person, the elusive idea of self, the elusive idea that they take on in a fashion of community and of importance based off of these men who look in this male gaze sort of avenue, removing their sense of autonomy and sense of selves, while Sofia Coppola ingeniously intertwines her camera to give them a sense of uniqueness, give them a sense of voice. It is in this hazy, dreamy, poisonous world of the Virgin Suicides where language is limiting. The idea of explanation, articulation, becomes a kind of imprisonment because the greater, more profound truths lie beyond narration and in the visual, in the experiential, and the imaginative. On its surface, the Virgin Suicides has the trappings of a tragedy or even a crime drama. At its essence, it's trying to say what motivated these horrible events and who's to blame. But the analysis of the central event, while it takes on the air of a kind of gumshoe determination or forensic investigation, it amounts to itself an inadequate answer. You know, why becomes an elusive quality that the Virgin Suicides almost negates an explanation, because it has a multitude of explanations. It has a multitude of reasons. And yet none of them really amount to a fullness. This movie is more of a meditation on remembrance, observation, and mystery, as could be summed up by the narrator's closing thoughts on the Lisbon girls and what they learned about them. In the end, we had pieces of the puzzle, but no matter how we put them together, gaps remained, oddly shaped emptiness mapped by what surrounded them, like countries we couldn't name. What lingered after them was not life, but the most trivial list of mundane facts. And it's this mundanity, the suburban mundanity, that Sofia Coppola is immensely interested. And it surveys a possibility of the why, because, you know, the movie opens up with Cecilia was the first to go. And it asks us, if Cecilia was the first to go, then who was the second, the third, and why? And yet the shock, the wave of tragedy that this movie fatalistically and noirishly surveys does not necessarily get to a resounding why. But the film's themes of adolescent isolation, religious abuse, and gender-based oppression give us ideas as to why. The Virgin Suicides brings each time its audience to a hypnotic contemplation of the worst-case scenario of teenage melancholia. And it's that contagious melancholia. It almost seems as though once exposed, once that reality has been exposed, once you realize the facade is around you, can you ever return? And that is at its consideration, its depth, the querying journey that is becoming an adult. Once you realize what is at the fold of what it means to be an adult and what are the examples given, why would you want to continue? And the Virgin Suicides, one of the most influential movies of the past 25 years, I think you could say that is a fact, because it has its traces of its own nostalgia and muted romantic despair. It can be found online and in depressing pastel filters of current, you know, Instagram accounts. Like, you can see it in the wistful movies of Greta Gerwig, and you can also see it in the sorrow and ennui from Gossip Girl to Euphoria. But Sofia Coppola's movie kind of stands alone in a kind of spectral, ghostly, and reflective and meditative look at what it means to be a woman in adolescence. And it's peculiar. It's probably indefinable, and it cannot necessarily be articulated, but maybe it can be felt. And that's the most we can get out of the reality of Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. And I'm excited to talk about it. It's a movie that I watched at an early age and as a young male adult, and I didn't necessarily understand it because, one, I was not a woman. Two, I didn't necessarily understand that it was skewering me as a man and how I looked upon women. And as an adult, I have a different sort of perspective and an appreciation for the inarticulable qualities that this has. And Sofia Coppola's pretty masterful early on direction to adapt this source novel and to express herself and these women as she subverts the expectations, subverts the ideas of them, and gives them a partial reality, a voice that I think is pretty remarkable. So I'm excited to talk about it. Let me get my guest introduced. Joining me in studio, Thurlene Williams. She's an actress and she is a friend. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm tired, coming off of sickness. you know, that's it is what it is. Yeah. And because it is the holiday, we're recording over the post-Thanksgiving holidays. And I feel like everyone got sick. I went to the grocery store, and there was no NyQuil, no DayQuil. It was raided, and so I feel like everybody in the world got sick. But I feel like that's the Thanksgiving tradition, you know, passing on illness. It's just that's just what it is. But Thurlene, you're doing well?
Yeah, just got back from Vancouver.
Oh, that's right. How was Canada?
It snowed when it wasn't supposed to, so...
Well, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it was fine. It was cold. I think I got sick there, out there. Or I was sick out there as well.
What is it? They got the Tim Hortons? Is that what it is? Tim's. Did you go to Tim's?
Oh, I went to Tim's.
Yeah, you did. Got a donut and a coffee?
Yeah, I did get... I forgot what it was called. I got their little Tim bits, which are just donut holes.
Yes, yeah, that's where they are.
Yeah, it was fun.
No, good. Well, fantastic. Well, Virgin Suicides, you... advocated, you put your name down, you were like, I'm interested in talking about this movie.
I did. It's the one of the few Sofia Coppola films that I like.
Oh, few. Oh, yes. Yeah, okay.
I'm not a fan.
Not a fan in general.
Yeah, but I do like this movie.
I do like this one. I like Lost in Translation.
Lukewarm.
Lukewarm, okay. Interesting.
Wow. I like this, and I like Marie Antoinette, and that is it.
Wow, interesting, because I like The Beguiled. I don't like Bling Ring. I need to rewatch Somewhere, I think. People have written quite enthusiastically about Somewhere. But I agree. It's funny because I don't like Marie Antoinette, but I like Beguiled. Like I like Lost in Translation, but I don't like The Bling Ring. Like, so for me, yeah, I agree with you that it's not like a consistent, concerted fandom out of the voice that here. But Virgin Suicides is one you like.
Yeah, I think it's her best.
That could definitely be argued for sure.
Yeah, I saw this movie probably when I was in middle school or high school, and I felt it.
I felt it.
I think this movie was also really big on Tumblr, so a lot of my friends had seen it.
Interesting.
Because they were like, at first I thought it was so unique because I knew what this movie was, and it was not on Tumblr. And then literally every girl on Tumblr can quote this movie to you.
I bet they can.
But yeah, I like it. I think it's good. I'm glad to talk about it.
Yeah. What was it about it at such an early experience that you were like, either this movie gets me or it gets to the idea of me?
I really think it captures how mundane and boring adolescence could be.
It is so boring.
Yeah. It's like because we see all these movies all the time and kids doing things that never happen in real life. And like, I could just, this captured suburban hell so beautifully to
me.
It's boring. It's a lot of sitting around doing nothing, and that's what I liked about it. It spoke to me.
You were like, I do nothing.
Yeah, I do nothing. Nothing's exciting. Nothing exciting happens to me in life.
The most exciting thing is perhaps my parents allow a boy over for dinner and
to watch a movie,
or to watch a movie, and sit and just awkward and just that festering awkwardness. I was saying to Katie when I was rewatching it, the early party when they allow the co-ed party and they're just sitting around drinking punch and not talking. I was like, these are boring ass kids. But that's the thing. Kids are boring. Yeah. Like, we're just boring. You know, and to be honest, I think most people are boring. Life, like, you know, you don't have anything
boring
to say.
I mean, even like in the neighborhood, like if anything happens, the smallest thing, everyone gathers and festers and talks about it.
Because you're uninteresting. Everybody else is so interesting.
You have to wait for a 13-year-old girl to commit suicide to talk about something in your boring
My goodness. Yeah. I mean, it takes a monumental tragedy to, I mean, that really is what it is. Cecilia's action is what thrusts everything into its kind of fatalistic gears, because it exposes the unhappiness, it exposes the boredom, it exposes the uninteresting qualities that everybody has. And that's why perhaps the survival of these boys who can recollect, it's because they're so enamored, so fascinated, so looking at these other entities, making women this entity that they can like decipher or save or whatever it is that is motivating them. They are they're able to survive because they are the uninteresting ones. Yeah. And they are making something so much more fascinating in their purview. Before we get our other guests introduced, I wanted to ask this question. You know, as a woman who's gone through the at adolescence, did you feel, I mean, this movie is very aware of men defining women. And like, I think Jeffrey's novel is about that, the experience of men defining this experience looking back because these women have no voice and cannot recollect themselves. They had this suicide pact. They're not here to tell their story. But it's all these men looking at in this realm of fascination. Did you ever find it a discomfort in this kind of in the oppressiveness of the male gaze, that your defining yourself was very difficult, or was it a challenge because we live in a society where women are sort of defined by society, defined by men, defined by that experience?
Huh, interesting. That's what I say to every question Kyle poses to me. Can you repeat the question?
It's really, in your experience growing up, did you ever feel like you were being defined by parental circumstance, where you defined by societal circumstance and the male, like when you went to school, men had an idea of you versus the idea that you had yourself?
Absolutely. Little known fact about Thurlane, because I hate to talk about it, I was a debutante. Back in my heyday. Wow. A lady that came out to society super fun. And I remember Harold is the guy that was my escort. And very much, I've known this guy my entire life, and everyone thought going to get married. And like, I didn't think this thought. It was just something that was placed upon me at a young age. Our parents knew each other. Our fathers were really close. And I bullied this boy my entire life, and everyone assumed Thurlane and Harold will get married.
Well, because when women give any sort of attention, whether it's negative or otherwise, it means you like the guy.
Obviously. Yeah. We, fun fact, got engaged. And, well, I've never been married. So that's how that ended up.
Fascinating.
But yeah, I remember like being forced to go to like sit next to him at dinner parties all the time. And people, whenever we interacted, I would see the adults in the room like make faces at each other. I remember it being referred to as a smart match. It was just that relationship was just so placed upon me, and I had no say in it. I never expressed interest in this boy ever, to the point where he proposed and I said yes because I felt
like
I had to.
That's awful.
It was awful. Wow. It was awful.
It's so interesting because while the debutante life is like this old fashioned, like going back to the old, like, courting days of like of privileged classes or equal classes, and they're commingling and making sure that there's good partnerships for land and cattle and all these things. Like, it comes from that sort of, exactly. It comes from this like old tradition of like maintaining the purity of your class. Like, it's such an odd thing. But even though that is so distinct and unique, we still, the reverberations of that are still in our just generic social structures. Yeah. The generic understanding of how men to court women, men to engage in that, that they are the one to pursue rather than women to have their own sense of selves and autonomy. So it's this movie, while trapped in the kind of idyllic suburbia of the 70s, sitting upon the assumptions of the greatest generation, 1940s, 50s, 60s, and where that was going to implode. All of these ideas of tradition versus autonomy versus, you know, this idea of societal regimentation versus self, that's in conjunction. That is in contrast in this movie. And I think that's such a unique experience, but I think it translates pretty equitable across the board. But let's get our other guest introduced, Mr. Regan Osborne. He is a writer. He is a traveler. He is an actor. He is a singer. He is a jack of all trades. He does it all. Sir, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me. Always good to be here.
Always good to have you. you. And Reagan, you always send me just a couple of little titles that you'd like to talk. Although you were very, you told me this was one of my best crafted seasons, which I appreciated. You were like, I love this season. I love all the options at my disposal. But the Virgin Suicides, you chose. And so I was going to ask, what is your relationship to the Virgin Suicides and why did you want to talk about it today?
I'm more fascinated with my journey with this film than perhaps the film itself, which has always been really interesting to me. I also watched The Virgin Suicides when I was a young kid, and it's having watched it recently in prep for this, it just kind of strikes me how I was one of those boys in the neighborhood that I didn't understand why these girls would do this. I didn't understand any of these things. And then to get to juxtapose that to hopefully a more adult perspective of the story as a whole, it kind of opened up a world for me. As far as the film itself, I think it's hypnotizing. I think it's beautiful. I agree with Thurlene that it is probably Coppola's best. It also drudges up a kind of nostalgic feeling for me. I grew up in a pretty conservative small town. I wouldn't label it as suburbia, but it was definitely a little town type community. And I just recognize the people, the characters in this film, as people that were in my neighborhoods, that were in my town growing up, that whispered about the pretty young girls in town and whispered about the relationships that were forming in the teen group and all of those things. So it's kind of like going home for me, which is depressing in its own kind of sense, but it's just interesting to me. And I'm a big Kirsten Dunst fan, so I'll watch anything she's in.
So I'll tell you this, this movie took on a different form of a kind of direct importance because I went to school with Kirsten Dunst.
Stop it.
Yeah. And because she was, and by the way, I think it's important to kind of understanding this movie. And I think what attracted her to the role, to the ideas, and why it was important for her in particular to play Lux and to play this image of the idea of the Lisbon girls and whether it's in the playful, seductive quality she brings, especially at this young age, because she had this quality to her, you know, I think in the general culture, it was expounded and even larger when you went to school with her, when she was in eighth grade and I was in fifth grade or so, like whatever the dynamic was. I forget what age gap it actually was, but she, you know, because she was in Jumanji, she was in Little Women, like she had this, she was up and coming and she had this, you know, it was a large scale name to her. And for her to take on this role and for me to have this understanding of her, we all talked about her. We all had this idea of her, like with this fascination with her. And then to watch this movie at a young age and not get it, you know, I feel even more shame for the time that I was engaged in that idea, because it is an interesting dynamic. And I think very much the power being played at during its time, the power of image of a woman that this movie is engaged in, it is trying to say that you, no matter what that image says to you, you have no idea what it really means, because there's a person, there's a human being behind that image. And that's what's so striking about rewatching The Virgin Suicides, and where a true meaning comes in is this elusiveness of their being, the fascination of their being is because we are so much less interesting than they are.
Yeah. I think an important distinction to make is I think there is something really beautiful, and there is a very innocent quality to the fascination that young boys have with young girls. Mm-hmm. I think where the problem lies is society as a whole, the adults in our life putting pressure on that perspective, on that fascination, in ways that are not conducive to people actually getting to know each other.
Yeah.
Thurlene, you talked about your experience. You and Harold could have been great friends, but instead you had all of this pressure from outside forces, adults saying, oh, that this is what their path is going to be, as opposed to you and Harold getting to sit down and have a conversation and him coming to see you as an actual person. So I'm in love with the innocence of these five girls are these incredible ethereal creatures that have this air of mystery around them. And I think if we put that kind of thinking in the beginning box of that's an innocent kind of thing for a young boy to feel. But now it's time when you're going to take Lux to the homecoming dance. Now is your chance to get to know her.
Yeah.
But because of the societal pressures, because of the adult influences in these boys and these girls' lives, we see the irresponsibility of Trip Fontaine as he deals with Lux. We see the kind of hesitation, nervousness that's happening because of the sexual awakenings of these two groups of people. And it just turns it all into the tragedy that we get at the end of the story. It's fascinating to see it happen that way because it does so often.
Oh, so often. More often than we'd like to really admit, because it doesn't necessarily go down the avenue of suicide pact, you know, in that sense of exaggeration or drama or tragedy. But there's little tragedies to be had, misunderstandings, misgivings, perceptions that are wielded and molded by, like Reagan said, exterior forces. And in this movie, it's there's an oppressiveness of exterior forces that I think are represented not only in the parents, but also in just the structures of institution, the formulas of introducing these unwieldy developing genders within the confines as they're discovering themselves. And then also not being given the right information for discovery, not being given the right avenues for discovery. And when you counteract that with a sense of fearing that discovery, which is represented by one parent, yes, by Kathleen Turner's oppressive Mrs. Lisbon, and the meek, ineffectual husband who is just so caught up in the past and caught up in the sense of the greatness of and the logic of things. Like, he is a mathematician, so he only looks at things in mere explanation. And so when it comes to the elusive why or the elusiveness of who his daughters are, he cannot even remotely get to that question. Like, he can't,
because he's not even interested. Yeah. Like, I don't think that's something he preoccupies his time with. Probably my favorite James Woods performance, by the way.
It's so against type, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just so against what we know as James Woods, the brash, over the top, slick, but slimy personality that you've seen in his career, whether it's in The Ambition in like Salvador or then you get into, oh God, like what's another really great James Woods performance that
even John Q, he's the slimy doctor John that Q. talks a mile a minute. And that's the thing, he's always a talker, but in this one, he just kind of sits back and lets things happen to him so passively, hides
he's
behind
so
his
passive.
Wife when the guys come to cut down the tree, like it's fabulous.
No, he's a super passive character. And I was going to ask you guys what you think of what that generally means. I think he is representative of an older male generation that, one, has no interest in necessarily preoccupying themselves with the ideas of the autonomy and lives of women, but also just a blatant, because of that blatant, I suppose, inexperience with them, he has the incapability of being an actual parent to these women.
He's what all those boys who obsessed over girls, he's the type of man that they become. And what I think he represents, is just, this is what's going to happen to them. They're going, because he lives with what, six women for 13 years, and he doesn't get it.
He doesn't get women at all.
Whatsoever. He should by means be an expert. I mean, his house, literally, he turned around every corner. There is a woman near him at all times. And just when Trip even asked Lisbon, Lux, on a date, he's just like, oh, a boy is like attracted to my daughter. That, why would that happen? Like, he doesn't see, he doesn't get it.
And could that be because he doesn't want to even think that his daughters will be sexual? Like
this is one of the themes of the film that really makes me tick, is there is this obsession with these five girls as like these innocent, beautiful little angels. And it's all throughout the town, in the adults in the town. Like, even when my favorite scene of the whole movie is when they come outside and circle around the tree and link arms, and they're trying, it's like they're trying to protect. This is like their one last shot at like We want to experience life. It's we want to be able to grow like this tree.
It's their one time to have a voice, like
but
in
then
anything.
The newscaster comes and she's like, I want them in their 90s. Get them in their 90s. And it's like, it's about capturing this image of beautiful innocence in white flowing gowns. And I think that's how James Woods, as the father, sees those girls. And he loves that because he got himself a wife who maintained that image for him all through their marriage. Yeah. Kathleen Turner is the personification of what innocence maintained looks like when it grows into a into an adult.
And it's
which is wild.
It's it, you cannot maintain it. I think is the thing.
Which is where her fear comes from.
Yeah, it takes on a nasty form of oppression, a nasty form of imprisonment. It's basically like, I fear what my daughters can become. And that's where they're not being honest. Like she dresses it up in all this, I blame the world, like, oh, these boys and their intentions and how what they're going to corrupt my daughters. But there is a denial that women can have their own kind of corruption, like, which by the way, that just means the general emergence
knowledge.
And knowledge of coming of age and like to become a woman is intrinsic to having that, is intrinsic to this idea of corruption. And we use that word corruption societally because that's how they view it. That's how they, and they try, and that's what she's trying to do. Kathleen Turner, it's such a haunting portrayal of a woman, either on the same level of like Carrie's mother in, you know, Brian De Palma's film, trying to to re-virginize herself, or trying to have a better, have a more pure understanding of that she can give upon these girls because the world is corrupted in her lens and in her view. And it's awful what she does to these girls. But the movie's not judgmental about it. It's trying to like understand this troubling dynamic that is not just in this household. It's pervasive throughout the society.
I just think it's fascinating.
It is. I mean, and it's because everybody has this idea of womanhood versus the individual idea, like the individual experience of womanhood. It becomes this abstraction, which is such an interesting thing when we define things in such general simplicities or generalizations. We then become further from the actual reality of what it is. And that's I think what generally is going on with Jeffrey Eugenides's novel. You know, Coppola wrote the script for the film in 1998 after the project was already greenlit by another studio, adapting it from the source novel, of which he was a huge fan. It's one of those ideas that you get that when Sofia Coppola was reading this book, she definitely visualized it and understood it intrinsically, how it could be visualized in a very particular way. And the inspiration for the plot of the book, it came to Jeffrey Eugenides when his nephew's teenage babysitter told him that she and her sisters had planned to commit suicide. When Eugenides asked why, the babysitter only replied, "We were under a lot of pressure." The film, you know, this kind of lyrical, unrelenting, dark, and keenly attuned to the perils of being a teenage girl, it's surprising that a man has written this. But I think he was very perceptive in knowing that he needed to write it from a direct male interpretation of an outsider looking in, written by a man from a male perspective, a collective male perspective, no less, that demonstrates the male gaze in order to actively critique it. It's a narrative device immediately seeming like a breeding ground for the male gaze. You know, that's very much the point. The boys seemingly decry the various types of gendered mistreatment the Lisbon girls suffer, from their parents' borderline abusive levels of restriction to one sister's statutory rape. And yet they actively participate in the sister's oppression. And this is, I think, pretty much linked, and we'll get into this momentarily. They obsessively watch girls without permission. They describe the girls' appearances in objectifying terms, and often can't even tell them apart, which I think is very distinctive. And this goes into how Sofia Coppola undermines the text by also interpreting a very interesting form of autorial interpretation. When the girls are introduced in their generic qualities as being blonde, floral, and whatnot, they are given their names in distinctive text, and as though they themselves have written it. This is an interesting note to take on through the rest of the conversation. With books like this, no one should really play the characters, Eugenides once mused when asked about the adaptation, because the girls are seen at such a distance. They're created by the intention of the observer, and there are so many points of view that they don't really exist at any exact entity. I tried to think of the girls as shape-shifting entity with many different heads, like a hydra, but not monstrous. A nice hydra, he put.
I also liked how his one note to Coppola was he had wished the girls would have been switched through scenes, depending on who they were talking to.
Oh, that would have been very interesting.
So you never really knew which one was which.
I think on a technical level, be even more interesting, you know, to kind of intertwine the lack of specificity in how people recollect these girls. I think that would have been an interesting touch.
But I think that really gets captured in the scene where Tripp is asking the father to take Lux out on a date. And that immediately makes Woods uncomfortable. And he's like, I don't know how I feel about that. And then Tripp is like, well, we'll take all the girls. And that is okay to the parents because they're like, well, if they're a group, they'll be it's fine. But it's like they're not understanding that each of these girls is trying to grow up. Each of these girls is on their own path. Each of these girls have their own desires, their own journey to go on. They just see them as that collective group. And it's like, well, as long as they're a group, they'll be safe.
They'll be safe. And which again, is an illusion. Like they're playing into these falsehoods. And that give it power.
Even in like the girl's reaction, I think one of the, I don't even know which one of them said it, but they say.
I don't think it's important to know which one of them
said it. Because it's Lux being asked out on a date and her sister's tagging along. And the girl even says, oh, they're just going to raffle on which one of us gets to go on a date with the other boys. Because this is the Lux show and we don't matter, essentially, is what's happening with this homecoming experience.
It is interesting. Lux takes on this kind of gravitational pull. Not only
she's the strongest of them. She's the one fighting the hardest to break free of this ridiculous oppressiveness.
You're right, because she is the most expressive and honest and open about her rebellion against the strictures, against the rules. I mean, that's why she is the most open. And, you know, on these rooftop rendezvous where the boys can engage in their fantasy. You're cringing already, Thurlee. It is cringy.
That's another thing that makes me tick, though. It's about when we don't have the information that we need in order to healthily pursue a self-finding, it's going to manifest itself in really destructive, unhealthy ways. Yeah. And that's what we get with Lux. Her parents don't talk to her like she's a real person. So she has no idea how to express or discover or investigate these feelings that she's having, this journey into adulthood that she so desperately wants to go on. And so she just does the only thing she really knows how is to get the attention of the boys, which the boys are also not getting the information they need. So that leads to massive irresponsibility when it comes to handling these relationships that they're trying to have.
Irresponsibility plus terrible, I think, instruction for sexual activity. Like just for
also very interesting. Sorry, I'm talking a lot. Very interesting that the boys are only getting information from each other. There's never a moment where an adult is talking to them about an experience with a woman or how to treat a girl. It's all the boys talking to each other.
I think the only scene we get that is when Tripp's about to ask Lux out and it's his dad's his dad and his roommate. And they again, don't know anything. They're just like, just be yourself. Don't call her on the phone. Don't seem too needy. That works for me. I don't. And clearly his dad is a gay man, knows nothing about women.
No.
And he's just trying to be yourself.
Look her in the eye. Her in the eye.
Any excuse to look her in the eye, because that's the romantic notion. I do think that this movie is operating on two levels, right? It's the idea that the coming of age of women is something that we fear, and so therefore it's something we refuse to understand in a lot of ways. But then on the other side, for the coming of age of boys, which is more understood and yet equally mishandled in a variety of ways. We are kind of left to our own devices, left to our own desires to kind of flail and to not necessarily be able to articulate it as well. I think this movie, while operated and concerned with the kind of tragedy that is the neglect of the female perspective, I think the male perspective in all of its domineering sense and its gazing and its inability to understand is also on its mind, which I think is presented quite interestingly through the form of narration. You know, Giovanni Ribisi is the narrator coming
perfect
in and
voice for it.
Perfect voice. Yeah. I mean, this, there's an interesting form of what's going on here where the voiceover narration has begun and continues heavily. And as in the novel, the narrator attempts to control the story, to overlay interpretations, to proclaim meanings and attribute intentions. And for all the boys, the Lisbon sisters are kind of hothouse flowers, girls behind glass, and the boys are kind of thwarted white knights. You know, they have this kind of savior complex. But again, this is not something that is inherent. This is something that is instructed. This is something societally expected. This is courtly love with all the chasteness and objectification the term implies. And its primary purpose is to not honor or understand the Lisbons, but to glamorize, romanticize their sense of longing. And Coppola is not necessarily interested in the fantasy, but she is concerned with the harsh reality of these women, but also these boys, that their glamorization, their fantasticizing of these girls is in itself a problem, but it's not necessarily their fault. The dynamics that we've set up in the longing for women from the perspective of men, and then this idea that women have to wait and be at the expense of men's interpretation, it's all of it is a sense of this kind of idea of minute tragedy. It might not necessarily amount completely to suicide and the complete removal. I mean, that takes its form and instruction from a movie we talked about earlier this season, Peter Weir's Picnic at Hanging Rock, where women look upon the world and basically transcend beyond it because it offers them nothing of interest. And it's, you get that sense in The Virgin Suicides. It's it's Cecilia is the inciting factor because she looks upon the adult world, the world around her, and basically proclaims, I have no interest. This offers me nothing. The environmental catastrophe that I am more aware of is impending, and therefore I don't want to live in a world where we laugh at people with Down syndrome, where we sit awkwardly in silence at parties, where we're not doing anything but just sort of involving ourselves in the mundanity. Like to just submit to the mundanity is so uninteresting to Cecilia that it cannot be fathomed by doctors and professionals. It can't be fathomed by our parents, but I think it can be fathomed by us that when we look upon what is promised, we would want to eject. We would want to press the eject button. And that's the closest we get. I was going to ask maybe you both how you felt about Cecilia as this inciting factor, because she seems as though she's the most mature, the most grown up, the most, as all the other girls at the dinner table are playing footsie with the guy in front of them, she is more concerned with the eradication of a particular species of frog. And, you know, it's because she's attuned to the world in a different way. And I think that does explain her suicide. I think it does explain her initial ejection from the narrative and from the life, and then also proceeds to expose everything around her from her her parents and their, I suppose, despondence their sort of obsession with protection, security, and the rules, and her sister's exposure to that they are at the whims of other people's instruction and interpretation, and that they are defined by the tragedy of their sister, if not by other senses and forms of society, never by themselves. And so it is an interesting character to talk about, Cecilia and her initial ejection from this life. Maybe Thirlene, what did you read about Cecilia? What did you think about the character, and what does it, you know, represent to you for the story that unfolds after her demise?
I think her suicide is, I mean, I guess because we spend more time with it, is the one that makes the most sense the movie, obviously, because like you see again the scene where they're at the party and everyone is like making fun of, oh, I forgot his, damn it, I don't know anyone's name in this movie, but the guy with Down syndrome.
I forget it. Is it
Paul?
No, I think it starts with a T. It's like Tony. Isn't it? I just watched it yesterday.
I literally watched it this morning. I don't remember, but the kid without, and literally she looks around, everyone is laughing, and she looks disgusted.
And
almost.
It's a kind of casual disgust, right? Yeah. It's because at its surface, it's kind of innocent. Mm-hmm. You know, do they genuinely like this kid? Who knows? You know, is he, do they laugh at him because he sings these songs and because he's kind of silly and he's, you know, a representation of something on a different spectrum.
Lack of information.
Lack of information. Well, it's a form of that they're getting entertainment out of a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And because they don't understand him, they are also finding humor in it. But she does not find humor because because it is mildly disgusting. It's casually disgusting. Yeah. It's one of those things that you would explain away as sort of an innocence, but its implications are there. It's like the misunderstanding, the lack of ability to really engage with this person as a human being is embedded in the foundation, in the social foundation, the social framework. And that's kind of toxic. And you see that. And I think she's aware of it.
Yeah. And because she's the first to commit suicide, it's the first one that everyone in the town, like we said earlier, she's the catalyst for everything.
Yeah.
For everyone to start talking. And people are keep like picking and choosing, like, well, why did she do it? Oh, it's because of how oppressed she was in that house, or blah, blah, blah. Like, everyone's trying to figure out why this girl committed. I feel like if you spent 2 minutes with that girl and just paid attention to Cecilia, you would get, she's so unhappy with existing, with her life. She's worried about the environment. She doesn't know what to do about that. I think when they steal her diary, every entry she has, she's unhappy about something.
Yeah.
And people are just like, well, I don't know why. Why would she do that? And it's like, because she's unhappy. She's depressed. She hates existing. It's very simple. And people just make this mountain out of it because they don't pay attention to her. They don't listen to her.
Well, I also think even the discovery of the journal, the diary, amounts to no information, really.
No.
Like, you know, she has these ideas of her sister, these imaginations, like these points. And it is a kind of ingenious method that the movie's taking on, that the novel took on, in this great feats of voice that the Virgin Suicides is narrated by this Greek chorus of unnamed men. Looking back on the adolescence and the suicides of five girls, the narrators are both elegiac, mordant, dipping in and out of lives, moments, acting as the collective consciousness of the entire neighborhood. And they're taking on this kind of procedural effort where they're exhausting cataloging relics at the time, exhibits 1 through 97. They conduct interviews with the most minor of neighborhood players. Imagine themselves in the heads of the five Lisbon sisters. They've tried and essentially to fully animate the past. But you cannot necessarily do that. Like, to understand a person is to be in their head genuinely and really. And the diary might be the closest thing that you get to Cecilia's understanding. And yet, I think there are gaps. There's huge gaps in the understanding of herself, her sisters, or at least what she's willing to put down in the diary. You know, it cannot explain someone in totality. And the movie is very concerned with Cecilia being a generator, a cipher, an interesting mode of initial interpretation that then seeps into the mystery that is all these girls. Because if Cecilia is a mystery, then they're all a mystery. And because they're all unique mysteries, we're all unique mysteries. Everybody is a human being. And so the movie is trying to sort of remove that idea of abstraction, remove and engage in that idea. Reagan, what did you feel about Cecilia as this, as first and foremost, this catalyst into the tragedies that therefore unfold, but what perhaps she represents in this idea of coming of age and this idea of awakening that she has had awakened and therefore could not be put back to sleep, and therefore death is the only perhaps way forward. That's one way of looking at it, but how did you interpret Cecilia, and how did it explain the unfolding of tragedy, therefore, that unfolds after her?
I mean, she was the one to see it first, right? She was the one that looked at her environment, looked at what was going to be available to her through the very thin lens that her parents provided, and decided, you know what, I don't want to have anything to do with this. And that's the ultimate tragedy, is because in life, there is such beauty in this world, and there is such opportunity for connection. I think one of the great things that keeps humans going as a species is the fact that we do have people in our lives who, I agree with you, Kyle, will never be fully understood by another. That I think that is kind of an impossibility, but it's the agreement between friends, between lovers, between communities but I'm never going to stop trying.
Yeah.
This is going to be a lifelong conversation of us continuing to try to understand each other. And Cecilia saw in her parents, saw in her community, saw in these boys, nobody here is interested in trying. So what is the point?
Yeah.
There's no point. And because her parents didn't give her the opportunity to find that beauty, to find that connection, the only other option for her was death. And that is tragic, and that is what I believe ultimately leads her sisters to seeing that same thing.
Eventually, yeah. Thurlene, looked like you were going to jump in. No, oh, okay.
I was giving
opportunity where it is required. You know, just trying to. But you're right. This idea of coming of age is all about awakening and coming into a sense of adulthood and what that means. A lot of us, if we were given the opportunity, you know, I'm not saying suicide's on the docket, but looking at what was promised, you know, growing up, you know, we're given this promise of what the expectation of adulthood is, what are the responsibilities, and you look upon the world, and some people have looked and said, well, I didn't ask for this, I did not consent to this reality.
I didn't ask to be born.
Yep.
I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask for this. And so it puts on the table this idea of escape, the complete ejection from that expectation. Well, I agree with Reagan. I think it goes into whether or not we're having the conversation, the productive conversation, if we're willing to try and be better. Because you're right, the movie's engaged in this, the idea of these girls, these boys are trapped and loving the girls from afar, or loving the idea of the girls, or the
it's like, what good is love if you're not going to understand me? Then do you really love me, or do you love the idea of me? And is the idea of me real? No, it's not.
And you're right. It in the movie is in constant conversation with the concept of the idea versus reality, and I think can be foremost represented in the rendezvous, in the homecoming rendezvous of Trip and Lux, because which ends in such it's so interesting, because it actually deviates from the novel quite a bit by not necessarily just generally explaining that he left and generally explaining his feelings about why he left, but the movie shows what happened to Lux in the aftermath. What is the feeling there of that isolated loneliness that she has? And that is pervasive in the interactions that she has with men beyond that, based off of that. That's the sole expectation, the sole value of what I can give is based on this physical embodiment. And it, you know, Trip in seeking out the idea of Lux, it's this idea. It's again, it's this idea. It's this girl who didn't, who you know, as soon as he sees her, there's like this glint in her eye, this like fantastical glint in her eye. Go ahead, Reagan. It looks like you want to jump in.
I'm so excited about that scene with older Trip talking about how once we were there, once we were on the field, things were different. And that's him coming face to face with the responsibility of the idea is over. Like I discovered it. Like I got the idea of it. Now I'm faced with, now I have to know this person. Now comes the responsibility of continuing the conversation of getting to know her. And because he has no information, because he doesn't have a solid foundation to stand on when it comes to actually dealing with the practicality of that responsibility, he gets scared. And he runs off because he's like, I don't know what to do now. So I'm out.
Yeah.
And he leaves Lux alone on the field and she wakes up in isolation and she sees what Cecilia saw at the beginning where she's like, oh, nobody's interested in trying.
The movie is much kinder in the language that he uses to describe his departure from Lux. I think in the movie, he's like, I didn't care how she got home. It was weird. I mean, I liked her. I liked her a lot. But out there on the field, it was just different then. That was just the last time I saw her. You know, most people will never taste that kind of love. At least I tasted it once, which is the most depressing, I think. Yeah. Lack of realization, lack of self-awareness.
Because it's not real.
It's not real. It's not real. In the novel, how he describes it is much unkinder. After he sums up the highly anticipated consummation, throughout the act, headlights came on across the field, sweeping over them, lighting up the goalposts. Lux said in the middle, I always screw things up. I always do. And began to sob. And then he said, I walked home that night. I didn't care how she got home. I just took off. It's weird. I mean, I liked her. I really liked her. I just got sick of her then. That's the wording he uses in the novel. And I think the implication in Sophia's not necessarily doing a kindness by removing those kinds of words to older Trip, played by Michael Paré, in a vile depiction. But again, I think it is also kind of playing into this ironic sense that men have this inability to understand, this inability, or that at least societally we are trained to not understand. Because,
and that's the thing, it's the disappointment when it's like, oh, this is required.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, this, she is a human being. Oh no. Now what do I do? And that's tragic to me.
Yeah. I mean, and it's shown that he is in rehab. Like he is in a rehab center at the a rehabilitation center. And I think that goes to show a lot of where Trip has ended up and where a lot of men end up, and this idea of venturing the idea versus understanding the reality. You'll end up chasing a lot of fictitious illusions based off of either drug enhancements, based off of fulfilling these void fillers and casual encounters. He is still sustaining an emptiness because he cannot deal with the fact that people are people. And yes. And that they will never amount to the idea that's in his head. Nothing will.
And because it's not their responsibility to. Women have their own lives. Women have their own faculties. They have their own. They are people as well. Lux had her own desires. Lux wanted a life for herself. And it's about that agreement of, okay, let's figure this out together, that so often we're not capable of doing because we have these ridiculous fantastical notions in our head when we're looking at a person.
Thurleen, I wanted to get you on the conversation with Trip. Like, what did you get out of this chapter? Because I think there are two moments that define the inevitable tragedy. The first is Cecilia and her suicide, and it breaks the crack. It showcases the cracks in the foundation. It showcases the unhappiness that nobody wants to talk about, and the toxicity that's pervasive in suburbia. But Trip leaving Lux and the crackdown on the girls, not necessarily and not bringing on a sense of empathy to their experience, to that tragedy, to try and understand them, instead imprison them in their own sense of abandoned emotion and isolated loneliness that I think once there's no turning back after that point, because when you start to blame women for the behaviors of other people, they shelter the burden, they shelter the weight, and inevitably they will also break. And so there's these two moments, and I think it's an important, the homecoming moment, I think it's important in the novel, it's also important in the film. How do you engage with Tripp, the idea of this, of him, and what it means to the girls, and how it shapes the narrative moving forward after him?
I always get angry when we see adult Tripp, obviously, for what he did to Lux. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I saw this movie, when he considers Lux like one of his great loves. I remember I vocally like scoffed at that the first time I saw it, because I'm just like, you didn't know her whatsoever. You don't know this woman. How can you love someone that you don't know? And I guess that's the point of this whole entire movie, is that, again, we don't really know the impact that we have on other people's lives. And people tend to not tell you the impact that have on them. Because, again, it's the boys. Most of this movie is the boys talking about, they live across the fucking street, you know?
Yeah.
And they're just obsessing over them, reading diary entries or every little bit of information that they can. I think they order the same catalogs that they do. So they try to like imagine like trips with them and all these crazy things, when you could easily just walk across the street and just talk to the girl. But lost in thought, I'm so sorry.
I'm agreeing with you. There is a level of disgust leveled here. That feeling is obvious. Because there is a, you know, in this kind of, in this moment, 25 years later, looking back at a moment that, by the way, undercut visually, you know, his idea of the self-romanticizing, the idea, the fantasy of Lux, because that's what it is. Yeah. I mean, there's an unearned glamour here, this aging high school heartthrob who treated Lux so shabbily. He only wanted the fantasy, not the reality. He wanted the projection, not the truth. And it's undercut. His recollection and his interview is undercut by Sophia giving us the closest thing I think we get to feeling the reality, understanding the reality of Lux. You know, as she appears ghostly on that field, and how she utilizes that color, that blue, to bring that sense of blueness and dourness to that feeling, as she finds her way hovering back, the Coppola, I think, is inviting us very much intimately into the world of Lux and the implications, the consequences of a trivial action that this man still views in a light as some sort of, I don't know, like reward, as some sort magical of moment, magical moment in his life. Reagan, go ahead.
I have a case to make for Tripp.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Which is interesting to me. And I think it's to Coppola's credit in that Tripp is just as objectified as the girls are.
Oh, very much so. Oh,
there is a lot of pressure on Tripp to be the heartthrob, to be the white knight, to be the fantasy for these girls. I love the scene when he comes to the door in the towel and she's giving him the exam answers or whatever. Yes. And as he invites her in, you see that it occurs to him, oh, I should probably invite her in because this is happening. Yeah. And then right before he closes the door, you kind of see him gather himself. And that is a preparation of, this is me fulfilling my role in this fantasy of I'm the heartthrob.
Yeah.
And he shores himself up, closes the door. And I think Tripp leaving her on the football field, yes, is the hitting the wall of, oh, now I need to treat her like a real human being because she is one, as well as him coming to grips with the fact of, like, how long can I keep up this heartthrob fantasy? How long can I keep being the guy that takes her to the homecoming dance, that takes her out onto the football field? The weight of that reality setting in on him as well, his own humanness, his own shortcomings as a human being, also not being recognized by the girls, the Lisbon girls, the girls in the school, the society as a whole that he's grown up in. I think it's the pressure of that as well that kind of drives his decision to be like, I don't know what to do now. I can't always be the hero. Yeah. And he takes off.
There's an oppressiveness to stature, oppressiveness to societal hierarchy, you know, especially when you're given that role, you almost don't ask for it. You know, yeah. And I don't think he did.
And I think that's why we see him in rehab at the end, because Tripp's still a good-looking guy. He's probably been playing this role his entire life. And now he's an alcoholic, drug addict, whatever it is. He can't do it either.
Yeah.
But, and it's because of those two, it's because of the distinction between the two that we get the tragic moment when it's like, oh, guess what? We're not fantasies. We're humans, but we don't know how to communicate with
each
other.
You're right. You're right. Because he was a heartthrob. He was this almost like miracle that, was walking within the confines of the school. Everyone wanted to be him. All the girls wanted to be with him. And that there's a lot of, you're right, pressure to the identity there. But you're right. It's something he never fulfilled. Like it's something that he couldn't fulfill. And that's why he's seeking out. He is in rehab. He's been seeking out other answers for it. And it's a combination.
It doesn't excuse him leaving Lux on the field. Like, dude, that's a shit move. You're a monster. But at the same time, we know where that comes from.
I mean, that it is interesting. I think that is the moment Lux becomes a kind of, you know, I think she was a ghost before this moment. She was a ghost, I think, in a lot of people's other understanding of her. But, I mean, she becomes herself a ghost. I mean, full of disillusionment, humiliation. This is a knife-sharp coming-of-age moment when you realize love isn't forever and people will disappoint you. This is a moment of a Cecilia moment of recognizing, you know, because Cecilia might have preoccupations with bettering the world. And that becomes on an ecological and perhaps structural way, an impossibility. And that's why ejection is the answer. But a lot of us find fulfillment in different ways. A lot of us find fulfillment in our base desires, our ideas of moving forward in life. I mean, that is not what pervades a lot of our existential dreads. We definitely want to have connection with other people. We want to have these romances. We want to have the ability to generate something of importance. And I think that that's an important distinction in recognizing Lux, who was venturing out what is atypical and what makes a fulfilling life for us all, and is left in disillusionment and humiliation. And there is no path. If there's no path forward for even basic relationship, basic understanding, then there really is nothing on an existential level, on an ecological level, on a societal level, governmental level. All these profound ideas are more daunting than they seem. And then even in the basic relationships, it is an utter tragedy because we cannot find understanding even there.
Which brings me back to, if we're going to assign a villain of the piece, I think it truly does lie with parents, though, because the true tragedy of the story to me is that there are people in the world that are interested, that are trying, and the girls were never given an opportunity, were never given the promise of an opportunity to go out and find those people.
Yeah.
And that is directly because of Kathleen Turner in this film.
I 100% agree with you. And again, this goes down the lines of what is a particular oppressive mode in American ideas about sexuality, about female sexuality. There is a Protestant foundation here that gives us a sense of discomfort with the openness about sexuality that is represented here by the parents, but also represented by the eerie, gossipy voices that you hear from the town in general. It's like when something is a little out of a mishap within the community, all you have is judgment. All you have is superstition. All you have is a base understanding of what's going on rather than an intimate and empathetic idea of what could explain.
Or an encouragement to leave that kind of toxic community. Like, you got to get out of those bubbles, especially if you're a person who is seeking something more. Like, get out of there. But when you have no champions within that community to be like, to recognize, oh, this isn't where you belong.
Yeah.
This is a path you can take to find it.
Yeah, because it's
five girls killing themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the tragedy of this family is really at their own doorstep. And it's unfortunate because they cannot necessarily see it. And I don't know if they essentially necessarily realize it once it's done. Because all their reasonings, all of Kathleen Turner, Mrs. Lisbon's reasonings is about protecting them. I want to protect my daughters. The world is dangerous. I need to, you know, they are interpreting the idea that the home is the safest place
I mean, what does she say? Go ahead, Therlin.
Oh, she even like points out at the end of the movie, after all her daughters get, they're like moving out, she's like, this was a house full of love, or yes. something. I'm butchering yeah. that, but they were not unloved. Yeah. This house was full of love. And I'm like, bitch, excuse me. You like, Lux got in trouble for wearing a spaghetti strapped at the dinner table when a boy was present, or putting her feet on, mm-hmm. I mean, we know why she's putting her feet on the table, but she got, there were the tiniest things. You burned her records because of the influence of rock music was tarnishing your perfect little angel baby.
And almost like suffocating exactly. the house, like suffocating yeah. the house in the process of burning and blaming something else.
Destruction comes from the inside. Yeah. She burned that house down herself.
Well, and it's interesting because Cecilia is such an interesting conversation, because I don't know if I suppose you could say the blame is essential, because she was just so intuitively aware as to what the response is and what the path forward was for her parents, based off of the walls that she was getting, the lack of understanding she was getting. Maybe Cecilia was prophetic in a way. She just saw the path forward that her parents, like she saw what her parents could become based off of the foundation, based off of the rules. And because I don't think you can in initially blame that she killed herself because of the parents. She killed herself for a variety of reasons, but her parents, and looking forward to how her parents are, and if that's the life, if this is the suburban lifestyle and dream that is being offered to me, and there's really no way of fixing it, then I must excuse myself from this mortal coil because it's unfulfilling.
I'm hesitant to remove blame from the parents in that specific circumstance, because it's their responsibility to show her, you know what, this isn't the only yeah. thing. This yeah. isn't, you don't have to do this.
But they're
that's
too,
the parents' responsibility.
They're too close-minded in their ways yeah. of life. Like, well, the father is just, he's obsessed with World War II planes and thinking about things in logistical, mathematical means that can be easily explained. And so he's locked away in an understanding of empathy, emotion. Like, that's just not how he views the world. Therefore, he also is a man and has refused to partake in his girls' lives.
Like, the only time we really see him interact with the kids is when boys are invited to their house. He, like, I feel like he's
putting on a show.
And he's sleeping in the chair.
Yeah.
Even.
Yep. It's like his girls don't exist until someone else makes him realize that they do.
Yes.
And yeah. it's like, oh yeah. boy, that's like, because like even at the party, he's like showing off his model planes to the boys. He clearly does not do that with his daughters, because just the excitement that it's like almost jumping out of them. He's like, finally, I get to talk about my World War II planes. And that's something he doesn't do at home, or even at the dinner table. He's talking to the
kids. He's just as giddy as the girls are when boys
yeah,
come over.
Because exactly.
he's like, and I'm not interpreting that in any sexual degree. I actually think he's an impotent human being. Like, I actually think there is no sexuality to him anymore.
He wasn't at a time.
I honestly think it's his duty. It was his duty. Yeah. Like, honestly, how we engage in the religious idea of procreation
they are clearly sex for procreation types of people
yes.
in that household.
Oh, 100%.
We know every single time that family, those parents have had sex. And
I think you could define it in very much that way. And I don't think they do anymore, because obviously, you know, Mrs. Lisbon is the one who's defining this household.
When he comes in to tell the girls that they're going to be able to go to the homecoming dance, the look on Kathleen Turner's face when he actually like sits down on the couch,
you know, I feel
and
about it,
she's like so surprised that he's actually engaging, and then it's terrible news to her, and she's yeah. like, well, we're going to talk about this later.
Yeah, we'll talk about this when you're not in the room, girls, because yeah. we're dictating your future in every moment based off of our predetermined fears, our predetermined realities. And it is, I mean, that's the function of its religious oppression, which is, again, you know, we are in a country that likes to chastise other countries for their religious notions and oppressions. And they might exist. That might actually be a reality, even though that comes from certain misunderstandings as well. We fail to contend with our own. It's all very embedded, all very casual in our language, in our attitudes and towards this just cultural notion of female sexuality in and of itself, because male sexuality is pretty much welcomed as just a boys will be boys, as a natural extension. But female sexuality is something just we cannot talk about, we fear, we put into a particular box, and it is truly the source of societal corruption based off of these fearful religious notions that it is Eve and it is the corruption and it is the knowledge. It gets very frustrating to continuously, you know,
it is fascinating how we look at it's fascinating how we look at, if we're putting it in the Adam and Eve sphere, if that's our lens, how growing up in America, boys are everything that you feel, everything that you want is natural. Go for it. Make sure it happens. But the minute you come across a female that might want the same things, dangerous. That's an Eve. That's going to lead you. That's going to get you in trouble. And that is so harmful.
It is. It's corrosive. It's societally corrosive. And it almost pins us to the inability to understand. The inability to understand women as men, you know, based off of what we're instructed, what we're given. And also women being put into a very particular mode and particular expectation. To understand themselves becomes a daring achievement. It becomes a form of rebellion.
And Therlene, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, how do you feel about this, Therlene?
I wish I could explain it. I'm going to end up sounding like those stupid boys in this movie. Again, my parents were very busy people, so I'm a little rat that raised myself, essentially. So I didn't really have too much interference, except for maybe when I was like a teenager. That's when people started telling me what I should be doing with my life and yada, yada, yada. Because I had gymnastics my entire life. Mm. In ballet, I had one goal, make the Olympic team. Obviously, I didn't. And that was it. And then I think when I got out of it, I realized that I hated gymnastics and ballet, unfortunately. And I was only there because my grandfather put me in it, and he said you could go all the way, kiddo.
You're almost like speaking that there is a kind of parental neglect, like you were kind of left on your own devices.
I kind of was, and I think because of that, because again, my teenage years were rough. They were not good. I think that's why this movie spoke to me so much, mm-hmm. because these are girls whose parents do not get them or care about anything that they care about. And I was just like, yeah, I'd fucking kill myself too. I think there were definitely times in my teenage years where I wanted to just end it all. Few times I attempted it, just because, again, I think when you were talking about the author's inspiration, he said the girls said that they were just under so much
pressure. Yeah.
I got a little bit of that, but for me, it was just no one cared about me. Like, I could just end my life tomorrow and life would go on. And I mean, in the movie, life does go on. They do their the next summer, like nothing ever happened, like a year after the girls mm-hmm. die.
Yeah.
They do their little debutante balls in the toxic scented air. I think
themed party.
Yeah, yeah. Asphyxiation
themed party.
Such a great scene. Yeah, I just think a lot of girlhood is just realizing that no one cares about you, unfortunately.
I think because of the fear, right? It's like I don't even deal with it. I don't want to deal with menstruation. I don't want to deal with sexual awakening. I don't want to deal with how the ideas that boys bring to women and their that dynamic. And so the parental disinvolvement, I think it's pervasive and it continues, and you get these notions with these men. Like, and I think it's a come back to the idea that it's defined through this male gaze, this male narration, this male recollection and obsession. Mm-hmm. They come to these girls and there are moments of tenderness in this dynamic that I think Reagan has been talking about the entire episode, that there is a complexity to it, because them reaching out in doing light Morse code, or, you know, having these late night phone conversations where they're letting the soundtrack speak to each other. There's chances there, right? It's almost like ships passing in the night, where they're trying to understand each other. The boys have, they're still caught up in a obsession, a fantasy, but the ability to articulate to each other the feelings and through lyrical expression, through songs, through music, through these things that could give us an idea of each other, they just momentarily pass. But and the boys take on this act that they will be their saviors, that they then take
that's all they know how to do.
That's all they know.
The information they have. They know that they have this desire. First of all, Thurlene, so sorry that you went through those periods. Glad you made it through. Yeah. Hearing you, seeing you, you're a champion. But that's all that's all the boys have. That's all they know how to do because of the lack of information that they're receiving.
Yeah.
All the boys can see is once we get them out of this house, we'll be in a car and the sun will be out and the girls will be smiling and resting on our shoulders. And yeah. It's like you have no clue the actual impact of what reality is.
Well, yeah, their chivalrous notions are, again, just part of the societal teachings that boys get. And the understanding of their own dynamics with women, which by the way, surveying these boys and their inarticulating abilities and sitting around in awkwardness and being boring, like they're just boring, like, you know, and they just don't know how to be interesting unless they attach themselves to a larger idea. And I keep saying that they are more interesting. The girls are more interesting, but honestly, when we really reduce it, they're not. They've just been made to be so.
And exactly.
Trapped in that house, exactly. And people have been talking about them. It's the illusion that, oh, well, why are they in that house all the time? Why did that one girl kill herself? And you just start going on and on and on and on about this whole fantasy life that doesn't really exist.
It doesn't. No.
All you had to do is walk across the street and talk.
Well, and it becomes very interesting, you know, the ending and all of its unfolding, the tragedy coming quite like the gut punches and realization of it quite immediate. You know, there's these flights of fancy, they're engaged in this sense of saving the savior complex. And when the girls lure them to the house with the promise of running away together, only to kill themselves while the boys are feet away from them. The boys seem to realize their mistake. We had never known her, the boys think to themselves when they find Bonnie dead. They had brought us here to find that out. I mean, that's from the novel. The actions of the girls themselves serves as the harshest indictment of the boys' tendency to both sexually and romantically objectify them. The girls take back their own narrative from their admirers by following the script of damsels in distress, leaving pictures of the Virgin Mary in their mailboxes, playing records over the phone, calling the boys over to run away and ride off into the sunset, only to kill themselves. Not only do Bonnie and Therese wait until the boys are in the house, distracted by the, you know, tantalizing possibility of romantic contact with Lux, to commit suicide. Lux waits until they have left in horror, so they will have to live with the fact that they might have been able to save her. Which is a haunting aspect to it. The girls very explicitly punish these boys, not only for objectifying them, but for arrogantly thinking of themselves as the girl's savior. And I think that's a very harsh way of putting it. And I don't think Sofia Coppola has that inherent sense of judgment to these boys. I think she is very attuned to the lack of emotional intelligence that we have at these ages, no matter what the gender is. And the
lack of education that we're given.
Yeah. The indictment is, you're right, against the lack of education, the lack of understanding, the lack of ability to communicate with each other. Where does that stem from? Well, it stems from parental neglect, which is at roots.
Neglect over interaction.
Yeah, well, and I think it's a neglect of their emotions and a neglect of their individuality. They are trying to do what they can to have these over pronouncements of protection, but ultimately are leading them to their own demise. And it might not necessarily be a suicide a year later, but years and years of that lead to disillusionment, dissatisfaction, and you see that within the boys. The mere fact...
Lead to Trip being in rehab.
Yeah. Leads to Trip being in rehab.
And they say every time they meet up, they try to piece everything together, and I bet you that night, or that morning, that those boys met up, and they were like, well, maybe if you, weren't late showing up, we could have, gone in, and, we could have arrived earlier, and we could have, that's a fight that those boys definitely had, and they just don't get it.
No, they don't.
They couldn't save them.
And the fact that they keep meeting up to try and understand, and that they keep missing the point, I think goes to the larger indictment. The larger indictment is that we all miss the point. We're always missing the larger picture, or the clearest picture, because we're entrapped. We're entrapped in our own senses of upbringing, our own senses of interpretation, our own senses of objectification. That's how we view the world. We're all trapped in these notions, and we'll never really understand each other unless we really put in the effort. We really make the strides to break those down. And
perfectly,
I think
perfectly captured in the final shot of the film, where the four boys are standing outside lighting a lighter as a memorial to the pedestal that they've left these girls on. And these girls will forever be in their minds now, which is the ultimate tragedy.
I think Sofia Coppola interjects the camera by making it look the opposite way. She's saying you're looking in the wrong direction. They're looking in the past. They're looking into their romantic fantasy notions of what they were, and trying not to really understand who were these girls, what individuals they were. And I really like that Sofia Coppola, and this might be leading to a conclusion. I like that Sofia, this is actually pretty masterfully directed work. And her working with Edward Lachman, at an initial stage in his cinematography career, how they utilize color, how they utilize this sense, at various points, it almost has the feeling that it's captured in a kind of Playboy-esque look at the world. In the 1970s, it's defined by an avenue of empty, salacious desire. And I think a lot of the girls are captured in this dynamic. Coppola, she was inspired by photographer Takashi Homma's photos of suburban Japan when choosing the filming locations. I have always been struck by the beauty of banal details, she said, and that is what suburban style is all about. This evocation is really at the center of it, the idea of mundanity, banality, and utilizing this evocative visual style with Edward Lachman, it suggests almost a soft focus haziness of a Playboy centerfold shoot from the era, mixed in with vague sense of dark foreboding lurking on the edges. It has this delicate color palette, a dreamy aesthetic, and utilizing these lovely blondes and our inability to distinguish between them, its poetic photography allows us this kind of ethereal beauty to transmit emotions and the feelings in this very accurate way. Sofia Coppola throughout is giving the book its authentic voice, of a voice of men, a voice of intrigue, a voice of obsession, but undercuts it by showing us realities at every moment, showcasing the girls and their sense of intimacy with each other, showing their dynamic, showing their yearnings, showing their articulations to themselves, because they are done in a kind of entrapment and in prison. Their parents are unaware, as James Woods meanders through the house, piercing through these doors, he's locked out. Visually, this is a movie trying to engage in the conversation. The tragedy that could perhaps have been avoided is that we have locked each other out. We're constantly within the barriers of our own homes. It's exacerbated with the barriers of suburbia itself. And so Sofia Coppola is ingeniously maneuvering the camera in that sense, understanding what the idea of the night dresses and the innocence it embodies, and that there's an allusion to that as well, showcasing that this sense of purity, this sense of innocence that we define women as, is itself an illusion, sitting on a bed of societal implications that are itself an illusion. And so I
also beautifully captured in the moment in the middle of the film where that we go to school with them and the camera's moving around as they interact with all of the other kids and they're walking down the hallway and they're like these angels of beauty. And then we quick cut to the static shot in the bathroom where they're all just kind of sitting there playing with the water faucet. And Kirsten Dunst is smoking a cigarette and they just look so depressed and
they do.
Over it.
Yeah. Their sense of ennui is, and the sense that we are bringing the audience into an exposure to their reality showcases that they are not these angelic creatures and that what we do to them
they're
boring just like us. And we need to keep that in mind. And it's interesting because the whole movie's set. It's set in Michigan, a dilapidation economically happening in the 1970s, the explosion of white flight into a sense of escape from the dire implications of not only integration, racial integration, but also of the urban space as though they see it as a kind of corruption. But you cannot escape that. It's, you know, these conservative notions and thinkings of the 50s and 60s versus the kind of libertarian 70s, they're going to clash. They were going to counterbalance. And they were going.
Is it something to be escaped? The thing.
And like, yeah, you bring it. I think you just bring it with you. You brought it with you and you try and hide what is deteriorating at the center of humanity itself. And it's just going to fester and rot. And no matter how deep you dig it, it's in the moldings. It's in the foundation of those houses. And Sofia Coppola is very much intrigued by that idea, very much exposing it for all of its faultiness, all of its tragedy and erroneous superiority, because of that it leads to tragedy. And I think it's a really masterful film. I mean, we could probably talk about it for even longer, but we did start late because I failed to record my opening, you know, and so I had to do it again.
The first one was
impeccable, but second one it will make do, but
but the first one was never hear it. You'll never really know.
You'll never know.
Experience the poetry.
You know, this movie is obsessed with watching, observing the voyeurism of experience. And we need to understand that when we lock ourselves into that inability to understand others, all we are seeing is what we are engaged with in a kind of superficiality of our gaze, then we will never really grow. We will never really understand. And I think it is the movie perceptively is trying to break that down, break down that perception, break down that voyeurism, showcase the fantasy, but also counterbalance with the reality. And it's pretty masterfully directed. I wanted to get my guest's final thoughts, and you can also comment on, you know, its visual sensibilities, Sofia Coppola as a filmmaker. You know, I think she is an interesting, you know, somebody who's found a very different voice than the one that she has come from with her father. You know, her father engaged with epic tales of foundational aspects of America and power and men. Sofia Coppola has interiorized and maybe grown up around these sorts of male perspective, has interiorized it in a different way and engaged and leaned into her femininity as to expose a different form. This is almost on the same level that Francis Ford Coppola did with the male perspective in Coming of Age with The Outsiders and Rumblefish. Mm-hmm. But Virgin Suicides takes on a more complex portrait of that dynamic. It's not necessarily exposing the reality of what life was like. It's trying to get at an emotional truth of what we don't see. And so she's an interesting filmmaker in that way. And Virgin Suicides might be her most refined work because of that, because she's exposing something very clear and very poignant about the experience that is often not articulated, not often explained, but definitely felt. And so I want to get my guest's final thoughts, you know, to summarize. Maybe Thurlene, how would you like to summarize our talk on The Virgin Suicides?
Well, one last thing I did want to talk about. I always cite this movie as one of my favorite character introductions in a movie, and it is when you see Trip Fontaine. I don't know. I for that that little, it's heart Magic Man playing in the background.
Yep, yeah, it's great. Yeah.
And it's like, from the second you hear his name, Trip Fontaine, and the second that song just starts playing, you know, this guy is cool. This guy fucks. And he's everything you want him to be and more. And it made me, like, I don't think I've ever been more attracted to Josh Hartnett than in those like 30 seconds I've seen. Cause he's,
that was the emergence of the sexual, the early sexual coming of age awareness of Josh Hartnett. Yeah. I think it was that, you know, you got like 40 days, 40 nights and some other, you know, Black Hawk
Peaked
Down.
In Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. But oh, Pearl yeah, Harbor.
He is in Pearl Harbor. Oh, I forget about that movie a lot.
Very much so. I mean, he is the heartthrob of a particular time and generation. And I think Virgin Suicides is the one that erupted. Like, I mean, that really brought it forth. I will say on that note,
that is also pressure for young men. They can't be that all the time. Oh yeah.
I definitely, I'm glad I was never of the Trip stature of either looks and otherwise, because
you are now.
No, not really.
Look at that mustache.
Not really. No, I look like curls. I'm in a 70s porn film. Like that's what I look like I'm in. No, I'm glad I never had that expectation because I never could be a Trip. Although I was in sports and there comes a lot of pressure with
the cool guy.
Well, not the cool guy, just, you know, parental. I had parental pressure. Oh. On the outset of my extracurricular activities, they wanted me to be a track star. They wanted me to be those things. I disappointed them greatly by quitting my senior year from sports. It's fun to be a disappointment. You know, it's every once in a while. But on the note that you said on introduction, I will say, oftentimes soundtracks are done in filmmaking these days. I think we can blame Jonathan Demme and Martin Scorsese for the infiltration of soundtracks and utilizing pop culture music in generating mood or generating period or generating time, whatever it is. Oftentimes it's a superficial piece. I will say, utilizing Magic Man, every song in this movie is utilized quite exquisitely, from Styx, you know, Come Sail Away, yeah, at the prom, to Magic Man, to there's a variety of songs that are used. And the soundtrack is pretty impeccable, not only to distinguishing its time period, but also, I mean, in conjunction with the compositions from the band Air, there is a certain sense of loneliness to it all. And that music also, at its expense, as I said, as a vein to try and understand each other, does not necessarily do so. We come to an interesting understanding of the lyrical content and the emotional content of those songs, but it is a bit more elusive than other films would have you that are most obviously used. And so it's done quite engagingly. And I do think it's utilized in, again, the introduction to Trip quite ingeniously. It's just one of the many instances where music is complemented in the notion and the tapestry that the movie is engaged in. But Reagan, how would you like to summarize our talk on the Virgin Suicides?
Something that I appreciate about Sofia Coppola as someone who's kind of lukewarm to her filmography is that she always does bring a specific point of view, and I think it's never been presented with more clarity than it was in Virgin Suicides, and that's why I feel pretty comfortable having the opinion that it is her best film. I was going to shout out the music. Glad we talked about that. Mad props to Kirsten Dunst, who can do no wrong, and
who has evolved into a really refined actress. You know, yes. Started off in her career in what we engage in a kind of superficiality of performance, like where not that she was never great. I do think she was. I think how she was defined culturally put her in a particular box. But she has she has really grown out of that to really define herself. Whether it is in like something like The Power of the Dog or Fargo, she is Midnight Special. She is a very very good actress. And
what I appreciate about her is even in her superficial roles. I mean, she was Mary Jane Watson in Spider-Man, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
She brought a genuine honesty to that character that it didn't really deserve on the page, but she managed to make that happen. I've always been impressed with her. But yeah, I think this movie has the kinds of themes in it that make me tick as a human being. And so I always appreciate when I watch it, and I have really appreciated my journey with it throughout my life. That's really romanticized, but I really have appreciated the point of view that I am able to bring to it, and that it always shows me as I watch it over and over again.
No, I'm gonna also say I agree with that notion. You know, this is a movie I didn't understand at a young age, and wrote it off at a young age because I didn't understand, and that comes with, you know, early age sense of, I suppose it's an early, it's an ego thing. It's you don't want to admit you didn't understand. You didn't want to admit maybe your faults at an early age. You know, I saw this in high school, and to confront the ideas that this movie does with boys at that age, I wasn't ready for that. You know, and I don't think not to say I was never exposed to more progressive ways of thinking or more interesting ways of thinking, accepting ways of thinking. I've liked to think that I've always been very wary of women in my life and their experiences and what I potentially could do with them, you know, or to them, you know. And this movie is engaged in an idea that you to fantasize, to romanticize, to put on a pedestal, that can be very damaging. And it is very damaging, but it's not the only way that we can, how we engage with women. There are other ways, and I'm glad to not necessarily have engaged in the extremities of either. I'm thankful for that. But I also, when confronting movies like this and confronting that perspective, have to come to an awareness that I've always tried to act my best, but there are definite failings. And this movie is like kind of a confrontation of men and their failings. And it's not necessarily that we're intrinsically or inherently to blame, but we are part of the equation. And to be part of the equation is a daunting thing to realize.
I think equally as important is the message of education, communication, and educated communication.
Yeah.
Is so important. You can't live in a fantasy world. You can't make someone something they're not in your mind and expect healthy relationships to come out of that. You have to do the work, take the responsibility of actually attempting to get to know people before you can engage in relationships.
No, I'm in total agreement. I think that these kinds of movies, if you're able to have that awakening and that realization, then the productive conversation might start happening. It's when you deny. And so I obviously at an early age in my denial or my rejection was not ready for the engagement in a productive conversation, but I am definitely today. And so I'm thankful for this movie. It's a special one. It's one that I will re-engage in and think about its implications, especially in how we carry on once we've realized what these considerations, what these voyeuristic tendencies, what these avenues of miscommunication do, the damage that they wrought, is something that we can fix if we're willing to do it. And so, no, I'm thankful for it. I'm also thankful for Thurlene and Reagan. Thank you so much for coming on board and doing this conversation with me. You know, Thurlene, you're an actress. Anything going on that people can see? I know last time we spoke, there were NDAs, so...
Yeah, nothing I can talk about, actually.
All right, nothing that you can talk about.
No.
Exciting, though.
Secret agent woman
it's
here.
It's literally just... Someone cast me, please, is where I am, but like... We'll see. Maybe
someone cast her.
Yeah, that's right. So hire me, please.
Hire her. Maybe she'll do it for food.
I will work for food.
All right, there you go.
I can cry on command. So,
so all you indie filmmakers out there, she will work for food. All right, because that's the least you can do, you bastards. You cheap bastards. Anyway, Reagan, you are a writer, a traveler. You were working on a novella, I believe. And any updates on that?
Looking at spring of 2023. That's right. The date we're shooting for, so we're going to see what happens. But yeah, there might be a little booky to read, and of course, adventures will always be happening. We're still working on hitting all seven of the continents, so keep an eye out. You might see me in a strange locale at some point.
That's fantastic. Yeah, Oz and Back is his Instagram for all those sorts of adventures. I'll tell you, Reagan, I'm actually traveling.
Yes,
I'm doing it. We're going to Japan.
And, oh, that's perfect for you.
Yeah, I've actually never been to an Asian country. So I'm really excited. I love Asian food, all varieties. I'm excited for the culture. I'm excited to see sumo wrestling. It's on the docket. So Japan in January.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm very excited for you. I can't wait to hear all the stories and see all the pictures.
Hopefully they're all good stories and hopefully we don't get kidnapped. I don't think that's a danger in Japan. I think they keep to themselves. I think
you'll be okay.
I think we'll be okay. Maybe I'll get a lot of people wanting to take a picture with me. I know that happened to my dad. So hopefully that happens to me. That'll be fun. Anyways, Reagan Thurline, thank you. Oh, I should let people know what's coming next. After Virgin Suicides, we're going to be continuing a dynamic of conversation on the fantasy or the idea of a woman, and continuing that in our conversations. We're going to be turning to the Czech Republic now, Czechoslovakia then, Miloš Forman's Loves of a Blonde, Andula, an innocent Czech girl from a factory town, is desperately in search of love. She believes she's found it when she beds Milda, a charming young musician visiting from Prague. Milda, however, is only looking for a casual encounter and leaves town, assuming he'll never see Angela again. But when Angela doesn't hear from him, she packs up, heads to Prague to be the surprise of Milda and his parents. It's quite a movie. Oh. It's super fun. Miloš Forman, who would do a variety of Czech New Wave films before he came to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus here. He is a great filmmaker. Looking forward to be talking about him. We haven't talked about him on the show, and so Miloš Forman, we're going to be talking about. Excited to do it. That's coming next. And so I want to thank you for listening, and thank you for joining I Know Movies and You Don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Brule, and we'll see you later. Cool.